This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Furkey, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of August 21st, here are a few top stories. In the news, President Donald Trump made a trip to the Valley this week. Following the president's speech in Phoenix on Tuesday night, protesters stood their ground as Trump supporters left the convention center downtown. Phoenix police say they arrested four people as violence broke out after a day full of mostly peaceful protests. KJZZ's Matthew Casey and Michelle Marisco report tensions rose after the rally ended.
The activist group Puente led anti-Trump protesters to the convention center around 4:30, and police ushered them into place behind barricades on the north side of Monroe Street. On the south side, the group Bikers for Trump looked out for the president's supporters as they waited to go in the convention center.
Well, you won't see our guys engaging with these protesters and screaming and shouting matches.
Chris Cox is the founder of Bikers for Trump.
In the event some of these Trump supporters don't feel safe afterwards, we'll escort them to their car.
After the rally, people exited the convention center near 2nd and Adams Streets, where they were greeted by a handful of protesters. Trump supporter Ingrid Maines smiled and waved as she walked by.
Yes, I said thank you for showing up. Only in America.
If she had stopped to talk with the protesters, Maines says she would have told them the rally was about unity.
We're one country, we're all Americans, we want jobs.
But unity was not on people's minds one block north of there. Michelle Marisco was in the crowd when protesters and police clashed.
As Trump wrapped up his speech inside, the crowd began to fade out into the street. Julia Nunn said she came out to participate in a Democratic protest.
I have a sense that things are moving backwards rather than forwards, that we were in a more progressive place, a more compassionate place, and within days of the inauguration, things started feeling different.
Protesters started marching toward the city's capital. At that point, police said officers were attacked with rocks and bottles, and the crowd began to run. Then police fired flashbang grenades and pepper balls at the crowd. People ran through the heavy fog, some screaming and others vomiting. One individual was injured and carried into a building. A police helicopter flew over the dispersing crowd. Tariq Watts was one of those leaving as a helicopter was overhead.
And I think that the spotlight is on Phoenix right now. We need all peoples to come together. We had Latino movements, Black movements, LGBT movements, trans movements. Everyone was there making sure their voice was heard. And that's what we need more of in a city with a reputation for being this conservative.
Police arrested two people for aggravated assault, a third for criminal damage, and a fourth on an existing warrant. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In the world of business, the Phoenix economy is recovering and more buildings are going up. Local nurseries are growing to meet their landscaping needs too, but have trouble getting labor to keep up with the demand. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn reports the federal government's response is to bring more temporary visa workers for companies that can't find Americans willing to do the work.
Beneath the scorching sun, Guatemalan workers move containers holding small green sprouts from a flatbed to the ground under a long shade at a nursery north of Phoenix. It's repetitive, boring, and hot. The nursery workers are wearing long shirts, pants, and a hat to keep their skin protected. This work goes on all day around the rows of cactus and flowering oleanders. They're paid hourly, starting at $10 an hour and up to $20. The nursery can't find American workers willing to take the job.
Well, we've grown from a two-person operation to about 120 or 130 employees.
Bill Cox started Arizona Wholesale Nursery 30 years ago and knows how hard the work can be because he's done it all.
They're out there shifting plants, you know, from one size to another, filling containers with mulch. There's weeding to do. There's pruning. We load trucks. We unload trucks.
It's work so undesirable, Cox says locals aren't willing to do it. So he turned to the H-2B visa program 4 years ago to start growing his business.
Without it, we literally could not have grown. In the last few years, had we not had this extra help, we would have had to close portions of our business. We would have never been able to handle the amount of traffic that we have coming in here without it.
H-2B visas are for immigrant workers who come to temporarily work in industries that have trouble recruiting American labor. This year, Cox received 59 H-2B workers and paid $50,000 to get them here. About 3,500 H-2B visas were approved for Arizona businesses so far this year. Almost half went to construction and landscaping. Nurseries nabbed more than 400 H-2B visas. Nationwide, there's 66,000 visas available.
It's a fair program. There's not enough visas, but it is a fair program.
Jan Thurgood owns Corporate and Employee Services, a company that contracts with businesses like Arizona Wholesale to do the H-2B visa paperwork.
The American worker has a better than average chance if they want to go to work, and that's a big if.
So it sounds like to do everything above board and legally, there's a lot of steps.
I think that's an understatement.
He says there aren't enough visas to meet demand, which has gone up due to a rising economy and a push for legal foreign workers. Last month, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security raised the cap by 15,000 visas.
It hasn't helped the majority of companies, and for some of them, it's been too late. They've had to either close parts of their operation,
or they had to downsize. Up near Bill Cox's nursery, a worker prunes small bushes at a nursery started by his son, Ryan Cox. For Ryan and his wife, Jessica, the fastest way to grow their young business is to bring in more workers to move more saguaros. Jessica manages sales.
We place ads for labor in three different local publications. We also do Craigslist. We put it on Facebook. We pretty much tell anybody that will listen that we're looking for labor.
But they can't get the local workers they need at $12 an hour. Ryan says he fields up to 50 phone calls a week of people interested. Maybe one or two show up. He says most quit within the day. One lasted 20 minutes. So they tried to get five H-2B visas for this year.
They are willing to do the work. They stay, they're grateful to be here and working, and that's what we wanted. That's what we needed.
It's still not an easy procedure. They've been approved, but the workers still haven't come. The Coxes were supposed to get them from March to October.
We've been looking forward to it since, I think, about October last year. So it's been, we have a shred of hope left that we're still going to get them this year.
If that happens, they can grow their business to fit the needs of their customers. But for now, the local nursery will have to wait and see if those extra visas will be any help at all this year. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And now here's a segment from KJZZ's original production, The Show, as we look at what it takes to make a blockbuster.
The Frida and Diego exhibit at the Heard Museum has extended its run until Labor Day, which means the museum has a hit on its hands. But what goes into selecting and promoting a popular museum show? Producer Paige Phelps peeks behind the curtain into the making of a museum blockbuster.
On a Saturday afternoon in the height of summer heat, when the valley retreats to sit under an AC vent, I went to the Heard Museum to see the Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera exhibit. If the streets of Phoenix were quiet that afternoon, there could be a solid case to be made that all of the people were inside the colorful exhibit originating from Mexico. The show has seen 70,000 visitors in less than 5 months. And more than a few patrons I saw that Saturday were dressed up in Frida-inspired clothing and headwear. Now, I don't know about you, but when King Tut came to town, I never saw museum visitors dressed up as Egyptian pharaohs. So what's changed?
I think it's a testament to these two artists, and I think there's something that's very liberating about the art, especially that Frida made.
That was David Roach, director and CEO of the Heard Museum. I sat in his office while the crowds in the gallery below us lined up to take in the photographs and artwork and the clothing of Frida and Diego, and also take selfies in front of specially designed selfie stations. This last detail is key.
Social media has played a big role for us. In an ideal world, people would come to a museum and they would be so engaged, so immersed, that they wouldn't think to look at their phone. I'm not sure that's realistic.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your modern blockbuster hit. A museum blockbuster means a show that's such a hit, people line up around the block to see it. The perfect example, Ramses the Great, featuring dramatic artifacts, mummies, giant statues, and have millions of dollars of marketing and production behind them.
Those are really, really expensive shows.
Amata Cruz is the CEO of the Phoenix Art Museum.
There are very few museums that can afford to put on an exhibition like that.
shipping, insurance, marketing materials, special displays, extra security, and don't forget the loan fees to borrow the artwork in the first place. Museums that take on these big shows find themselves on the hook for payments upon payments, and they need it to be a hit, which means visitors. Lots and lots of visitors.
When you think about a blockbuster, you think about standing in line, let's say outside, whether it's hot or cold, and getting into an exhibition that is completely packed with a lot of people. It's not the best way to look at works of art either. And so there was a little bit of fatigue on the part of viewers and even museums that at the end thought, you know, if we're not recouping our costs, which is really why you do a blockbuster, and people are a little bit alienated because they don't get that real engagement one-on-one with a work of art, maybe it's not really worth it to do a blockbuster. We may actually be in a post-blockbuster world now.
Cruz has overseen her own hugely popular exhibits. Gehinde Wiley, an African-American painter of huge, colorful portraits, logged 7,000 visitors on opening night at PAM. And Samurai Armor was the most popular show under her direction to date. 50,000 people came through the art museum in 4.5 months. And while PAM doesn't like to talk specific numbers, those were in the realm of a blockbuster, sort of.
Blockbuster shows cost millions of dollars, and the Samurai Exhibition didn't have quite that high of a ticket price. Now, we also define success not just according to how many bodies have come through. We define success in other ways, such as engagement.
So how do you bring in the bodies without the blockbuster budget? Here's David Roach of The Herd again.
There are studies, fascinating studies, that what people want when they come to a museum, they want an experience that they can't have anyplace else, and they want to have an emotional experience. Now, 25 years ago, people probably would have told you that they came to a museum to learn. I somehow sense that maybe it sounded better to say you wanted to come and learn and be educated. What has emerged on the landscape as a major competitor is technology. It's the cell phone and the iPads and the computer and people having virtual experiences instead of real experiences.
We're looking at the installation Immersive Artwork by a British collective called Squid Soup, and the piece is called Submergence, Ocean of Light. So Ocean of Light is the name of the entire piece. Whoa.
Oh, wow. That's so amazing.
It never gets old for me hearing people go, ooh.
That's Sarah Cochran, director and chief curator of the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, SMOCA. And the fanciful exhibit called Submergence that we're inside of? It's a series of hanging digital lights, and it feels like the inside of a disco ball at the height of Studio 54.
This is part of an evolution in art-making practices. We do still have exhibitions of paintings, but they are not your traditional exhibitions of paintings. And artists themselves have kind of leaped off the wall and off the pedestal.
The work is bringing in the number of people SMOCA is used to seeing in a week, in a single day. This is the type of lean budget, big bottom line bang museums would love to see more of today. Back at The Herd, I asked David Roach.
From my research, it seems that museums tend to spend about 1/3 of their operating budget on a revenue-generating opportunity.
I'm not sure that would hold true for The Herd. Like a lot of museums, since 2008, The Herd has really had to cut back significantly. And as a result, our exhibitions and our programming, I think, suffered. We are very much in the process of turning that around. And certainly, this exhibition gave us an opportunity to say loud and clear to the world that The Herd is active and engaged and doing important work. I certainly had many sleepless nights thinking about the cost of this exhibition. What if nobody shows up?
Tapping into that elusive thing that makes a hit show is something that museums, large and small, struggle with. Sarah Cochran again.
The question is, what is a blockbuster? We know that there are things that capture the zeitgeist, and in many ways I would say Squid Soup in Phoenix, Arizona has caught the zeitgeist. And I mean, the thing that's difficult for museums is that it's no longer necessarily just what we program. It's also about this kind of lightning in a bottle.
As mysterious as that sounds, lightning in a bottle actually has a pretty clear track record of late. It's the kind of show where visitors don't just stand behind a velvet rope and gaze at a master Vermeer, but they go in and they touch and they feel and they even play inside the art. This experience is called immersive art, and it seems this is the new wham bam of the museum exhibit. One example is Pam. They filled a room to the ceiling with white balloons by artist Martin Creed. Amada Cruz again.
So let's take that Martin Creed balloon installation as an example. When you think about a room of balloons, you think about happiness and joy and being a child. But then you got into the room, and it became a little bit more complicated. And that's about processing an experience in a very visceral way. To me, that is just as valid an experience of a work of art as looking at a beautiful Monet painting.
The Frida exhibit at the Herd is extended for 2 weeks, but they're already thinking ahead to their next show. I wondered if Roach could replicate the success.
Moments like this are usually few and far between. It's part of what makes them so special. What this exhibition is doing for the Herd is that people are coming in to see Frida and Diego, but they're staying. And so striking that balance of having exhibitions and programming that bring people in and that they come back, all of those things are really important.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Paige Phelps.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke says none of the 27 monuments under review should be eliminated, but a handful should be changed. From the Fronteras Desk and Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Zinke has recommended to the president that the 1.35 million-acre Bears Ears National Monument in southern Utah be reduced in size. Native American Rights Fund attorney Matt Campbell says Bears Ears is inextricably tied to Native history, culture, and people.
Bears Ears is one of the most important places for all of Indian Country. Five tribal nations came together to push for the Bears Ears National Monument. And so any attack on Bears Ears to revoke or diminish it would be attack on all of Indian Country and all of America.
And Campbell says they plan to fight the decision in court. In April, President Trump ordered a review of the monuments, responding to complaints that a centuries-old law had been misused to create oversized monuments that stood in the way of energy development, logging, and other uses. The Interior Department received 2.4 million public comments, the majority in favor of protecting the monuments. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
In education news, here's the show's Mark Brody.
A federal judge has ruled racial animus was behind a law banning Tucson School's Mexican-American Studies program. The 2010 measure, among other things, bans classes that promote resentment toward a race or class of people. The Tucson Unified School District ended its program in 2012 at the risk of losing state funding. With me to talk about the ruling is Nolan Cabrera. He's an associate professor in the University of Arizona's Center for the Study of Higher Education, where he studies the efficacy of the Mexican-American Studies program, among other things. He was also an expert witness for the plaintiffs in this case. And Nolan, in your mind, what does this ruling mean?
Well, first of all, it's the biggest, most high-profile ethnic studies case in the history of the country. And at the same time, and so it's a vindication for so many years of protracted struggle. And it's also a really important statement that racism and racial animus that drives social policy will not stand.
What practical impact will this have? I mean, the district has not said, as far as I know, whether or not it plans to re-up this program or not. So, like, what kind of practical impact might it have?
Well, from my understanding, the district has said it's not going to re-implement the program, regardless of what the ruling was. So the practical impact in that sense is none. But in terms of relieving pressure from the state, that's incredibly important. I mean, that you need to understand that teachers who were participating in the Mexican-American Studies program, and even those who maybe weren't necessarily affiliated but might be using some materials like that, were subject to an incredible amount of scrutiny, both from the district and the state, but always at behest because of the law that was in place, having to turn over curricular materials, lesson plans, unannounced site visits to make sure that they weren't stepping outside of the parameters of the law. And so in that sense, that the ruling is really important because it removes that sort of surveillance mechanism from the state.
It sounds like you're saying that it gives teachers and maybe administrators as well a little more freedom in the classroom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not even more freedom. It's just sort of trying to return to what was the normal course of action in your classroom.
Do you think that even if the district doesn't start up the entire program again, that maybe elements of it after this ruling could be implemented into English classes, into social studies classes, other types of classes, even if it's not a full-on program?
I sincerely hope so, but I also go back to the issue that, because I was running the statistical analyses on the program about its efficacy, and where we saw the strongest relationship between taking Mexican-American studies and student academic achievement was when there was a full-blown program, when it was coordinated. For all intents and purposes, this was the largest Mexican-American studies, or actually any ethnic studies program in K-12 institution in the entire country. And so, you know, if we're going to try to replicate those successes, then yeah, it can't be done piecemeal. It needs to be done intentionally. It needs to be done in a very coordinated way.
So I guess given that, do you think that the law, even though it has been struck down, kind of served the purpose that supporters envisioned in terms of not having this program up and running in this district?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question in my mind that the ultimate goal, both Mr. Horn and Mr. Hoopenthal, was the complete elimination of this program. I mean, that's not my interpretation. Those are their words. And to that end, yeah, they actually did meet their goal in that sense. But in an interesting and sort of ironic twist of fate, the example of Tucson has become central in the organizing and around and development of ethnic studies curriculum throughout the nation. So when LAUSD or San Francisco Unified or Portland Public Schools or Seattle Public Schools or Nevada or Denver or Texas, as these debates are happening and as laws are getting passed, creating ethnic studies requirements for graduating from high school, the example of Tucson is consistently part of that discussion. And so even though it got stamped down in Tucson, it's growing throughout the country. In sort of the old parable that they tried to bury us, but they didn't realize we were seeds.
Nolan Cabrera is an associate professor in the U of A's Center for the Study of Higher Education. He was also an expert witness for the plaintiffs in the ethnic studies lawsuit recently ruled on in Tucson. Nolan, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
In the 1970s, the popularity of pro football grew tremendously, but some say the long-term effects of head injuries have put the game in an existential crisis. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Matthew Casey reports on a Goodyear man who played in the National Football League when headshots were perfectly legal and usually celebrated.
See, I can't swing this because my shoulder doesn't give me any strength.
A monsoon storm knocked over a plastic shed in Carl Barisic's backyard, so he's using a sledgehammer to take it apart. Barisic played in the NFL in the 1970s and 80s.
When I was playing, I liked competing and I liked hitting people.
The 66-year-old has a degree from Princeton. He also has metal in both knees, a hip, and the shoulder that's bothering him.
Actually, the joints that have been replaced in many ways feel better than real ones I have left.
Barisic won't let arthritis disrupt retirement with his wife. Next month, they'll raft the Grand Canyon together. But the headshots Barisic took in football could interfere with their plans down the road.
I don't know whether the things that I experience in my life are a sort of natural aging process or my natural aging process has been accelerated by this brain trauma.
Barisic doesn't worry if he'll get chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. It's the brain disease linked to football. A recent study found CTE in 110 of 111 former NFL players. Knowing about CTE would probably not have changed Barisic's decision to play.
I'd figure, just like everybody does, I'm the guy that's going to beat the odds. And I still am the guy that's going to beat the odds. My buddy Tom, well, he didn't quite beat him.
Tom DeLeon and Barisic shared their families as much as football. After DeLeon died last year, doctors found advanced CTE in his brain. Barisic held his best friend's hand as he passed away.
It was very moving, and he knew I was with him, and so that makes me feel good.
De Leon and Barišić met through the violence of football. They played on different teams then, and on a punt play, De Leon said hello.
Out of nowhere, he blindsided me. He lifted me up off my feet, and I came down. I landed on my feet, but I wasn't quite sure where I was.
Barišić doesn't know how many concussions he had. They were diagnosed differently 40 years ago, says Dr. Javier Cardenas.
Anything less than getting knocked out was not a concussion. We know now that's not the case.
Cardenas is a brain expert and NFL consultant. He says doctors are trying to figure out the effect of hits that don't produce concussion symptoms.
The big question, the big concern is, are these also damaging to the brain? At this time, we simply don't know.
As a defensive lineman, Barišić got hit in the head during every game and every practice. Most football players had side jobs back then because pay was much lower. So the pressure to be on the field was greater, says Kevin Cook. He wrote a book about the era called The Last Headbangers.
You were definitely not tough if you sat out.
The rules were different too, says the Massachusetts-based author. Head-to-head hits were glorified, and players could use their helmets as weapons to hurt the opponent.
There's no doubt that men are today senile at 50, are dying earlier, are suicidal solely because they played football, and not just NFL players.
Barišić and his grandchildren do jigsaw puzzles in his living room.
This is a pretty good one, isn't it?
Yeah. This one Grandma got was actually really hard.
The kids live across the street in Goodyear. Barišić and his wife plan to spend a big part of retirement with their grandchildren.
Find all the corners and then find all the edges.
Puzzles help keep the mind limber. Barišić has done tests so doctors can better understand how football impacts people's brains. But they're double-blind studies, so he'll never know the results. Overall, Barišić says he feels good.
I go any place I want to go, and, you know, I climb mountains, and I do what I have to do to have fun and to live life.
Doctors can only diagnose CTE post-mortem, and Barišić will donate his brain and spinal column to science after he dies. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Goodyear.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischmann, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.